Hi, this is Eric Schlein of the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today's episode of the Intelligent Investing Podcast is sponsored by Red Rock Running. Runners and joggers out there, tell me if this sounds familiar. You go into your local running store to pick up some gear, first the shirt, and as you browse the shirts, you see that nice, high-quality performance shirt running you at least $40. Then, you need something to carry your smartphone so you can listen to the Intelligent Investing Podcast while you run. Or maybe you want to track your run with a GPS. A smartphone carrier costs something like $20 or $30. And between work, family, and other responsibilities, the only chance many of us have to go for a run is early in the morning or late at night. That often means running in the dark. So, to help stay safe, you need a reflective vest to increase visibility. That's another $10, $15. So, in total, you can expect to spend over $100 just for gear that goes on your upper body. Red Rock Running has a better way. Their new Bryce running shirt combines all three of those products into one simple item. Secure pockets built directly into each sleeve carry your smartphone or other audio device, a couple of keys, headphones, or energy gels. Strategically placed, reflective material increases your visibility, keeping you safe when running in the dark. Intelligent Investing Podcast listeners know the importance of value. Purchasing a technical shirt, smartphone carrier, and a reflective vest separately costs over $100. The Bryce running shirt, however, gives you all three for only $59. And Red Rock Running is offering listeners this podcast an additional 15% off any purchase by using the promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So that's right, listeners, if you are a listener of the Intelligent Investing Podcast, you get an additional 15% off any purchase of a shirt that's already a good value by using that promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So remember, go to Red Rock Running, REDROCK running.com and receive 15% off your Bryce running shirt with promo code INVESTINGPOD, INVESTINGPOD. Carry more, increase visibility, decrease hassle.
Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein, and you're listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, Episode 9. Today we have Travis Weador, who specializes in small cap and micro cap stocks. He is the managing director of Weador Capital and also runs the blog Egregiously Cheap. Welcome to the show, Travis.
Thanks for having me on, Eric.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully by the end of this episode, all of our listeners will adore you, and then we can all say that we adore you. I'm sure you get shit like that a lot, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Well, welcome to the show. It's I'm glad to have you on. I know we've gone back and forth for a few weeks. So tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and your background, and then we can just jump right into it.
Yeah, I started investing right during the financial collapse. I was actually playing professional poker at that time, and investing in poker have a lot of things in common. Started investing on the side and got really lucky starting in like 2009, coming out of there, and thought, hey, this is great. I need to do this more often. Just kind of slowly over the years, that started as a side hobby and grew into an obsession that was eventually, I was spending more time on investing than I was my real job. And then about a little over 2 years ago, I started my own investment firm, and still very small, mostly managing, you know, family and friend money, and have picked up a few outside investors along the way, and here we are.
Very cool. Now, you specialize in small and micro cap stocks, right?
Yeah, I don't have a strict like market cap rule. No, I do own Interactive Brokers, which is like a $14 billion company, right. But That's definitely the exception. I really only look at companies that are in like the several hundred million range and smaller.
Now, do you buy
Are you buying stakes only in public companies, or do you do stuff with private as well?
Only public companies. Kind of interesting you ask that. I've started to learn a little bit more. I have a friend who invests in private companies, and he's done very well. Some of the valuations in private companies are absurd compared to what we public investors see on a regular basis.
Yes. So let's just jump right into it. Can tell us a little bit about maybe some interesting situations that you've been looking at and how you value them. You want to start with that?
Yeah. In terms of stocks that I like at the price today, Where Food Comes From is one company that, you know, I've talked about before. And
just so we're clear, you're not asking a question that the company is called.
Yes.
Where Food Comes From
is, it's really that's the name of kind of their umbrella corporation. That's not really what they do business as. So they are a third party auditor for like farmers, and they mostly do protein. So if someone wants like a non-GMO certification or organic certification, or they want to export their beef to Europe, which requires a certain certification, Where Food Comes From will go out to that farmer and do a audit and allow that person to use whatever label they're wanting to use or whatever. And they're kind of the dominant person in that space, especially in the protein area. They have two very small competitors, but they are basically the entire industry, if you will. And then they're also expanding into, they bought a company that audits like wineries and almond orchards. So there's a whole lot of audits and stuff that go on in the broad food industry, and they're basically trying to dominate that space.
And how did you find this company?
I actually went through, I think I mentioned it on my blog, I went through a list of every over-the-counter company in America, which was, I think, like 1,500 companies. I've actually gone through that's not the entire list. I first narrowed it down. But I've gone through that list, I think, three times now. And that's one of the companies I came across the last time I did it, maybe 2 years ago.
And how big are they?
They are tiny. I mean, maybe 50 million. I think in the ballpark of 50 million. And it's kind of an interesting situation in that I talk about this company a lot just because I find it interesting, and it's something that a lot of people are kind of familiar with the space, even if they're not an investor or anything. But people always love the company and the basic idea until you get to the valuation where they see that stock's down for like 80 or 90 times trailing 12-month earnings.
Yeah. Excuse me. So is this something that you're a shareholder in?
Yeah. And I think I started purchasing it maybe last fall-ish.
Okay, and what was the valuation, the thesis? Go into that a little bit of your thinking behind that for us.
It was basically the stock really hasn't moved much since I bought it. I think I might be up a few percent or something. It's right around that same price. But obviously, I'm not valuing it on current earnings or even what they're going to do in the next 12 months. But it's one of those things where when I look out 5 or 10 years into the future, it's just hard. It's hard to imagine that industry not being significantly larger than it is today. The whole like auditing of food producers is an industry that's very much in its infancy. So I feel like 5-10 years from now, that could easily be a several $100 million industry, if not more. And then, you know, the next question is, will where food comes from continue to dominate the industry like they do today? And, you know, I think there's a very good chance they will. So it's that valuation definitely comes from looking several years out. It's very much a long-term holding. You know, people, you know, the old adage, like, if the stock market closed tomorrow for 10 years, what companies would you own? And that's only one of two companies that I currently own that I would be comfortable, you know, just owning for a long time.
For a decade.
Yeah, because I just think there are so many tailwinds behind the company. And I don't think that that competitive position will be eroded away, you know, very easily, at least. Of course, anything's possible.
Now, are they doing this? Do you know if they're doing this in, not the specific company per se, but do countries, say, like, you know, places in Europe and India and Asia, are they doing things like this as well? Are there companies out there internationally with similar business models?
I don't know about specific companies. I would assume so. That's a good question. Although that, you know, it's one thing about that business is you have to be a local company. So I'm not exactly worried about some European food auditor taking over, you know, these American farmers.
Yeah.
But one kind of interesting point that relates to what you said is that the U.S. is one of only two countries that exports beef and doesn't have a full what's called a traceability program, where you trace like a calf from when it's born on a farm, and then you trace it through its entire life. So of the, I think there's like 15 or 17 countries or something that export beef around the world, and only two of those don't have a fully fleshed out traceability program. And the U.S. is one of those. But they are, and that's part of where food comes from business. And that's certainly one of the growth areas is there's a lot of push to get, you know, a full traceability program in the United States.
And what's the other one?
The other country. What?
You said the United States is one. Do you know? I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's probably in my notes. I can't think of it off the top of my head.
Well, that's all right. Interesting. And then what's the other company that you're currently a shareholder in that you would essentially be able to buy and then go to sleep for 10 years?
The other one is Interactive Brokers, which I mentioned before, and I think is as different as their business models are, I do feel like they have a lot of similarities in that, you know, they have very strong competitive positions kind of in small niches, and they're both trying to expand those niches, and they both have owner operators who have founded the company and are extremely passionate about what they're doing.
So walk listeners through, because I don't think most people actually know the business model of an interactive broker. So let's say a company with a good reputation, like Schwab, for instance, right?
Mm-hmm.
How would you compare a company like Schwab with a company like Interactive Brokers? Because I think most people look at them and say, oh, well, they're both, you know, discount brokerage firms. So what's the difference?
Yeah, I'd say there are two very big differences. One, Schwab has, and I've the past couple of days I've been working on an Interactive Brokers write-up, so I actually know some of these numbers right off the top of my head. Schwab has 335 retail branch locations throughout the United States.
You know, that would have sounded way cooler if you didn't just say that. You just started running off these numbers. I would have been like, holy shit.
Ah, damn it. So they have 335 retail branch locations. Interactive Brokers has zero. So right off the top of, you know, kind of right from the start, Schwab's overhead is significantly more than Interactive Brokers. Interactive Brokers is they automate as much as they can possibly automate. So they have a corporate headquarters, and I think like half or slightly over half of their employees are programmers, and that's completely what they're focused on. And then the second big thing is that Schwab sells all order flow. So if you're a Schwab customer and you place an order, Schwab actually sells that order to a high frequency trading firm, and the high frequency trading firm executes that order for the Schwab client. Interactive Brokers does all their own execution. So they handle all their own order flow. They don't sell the order flow. So when you combine those two things, a lower overhead and they handle their own execution, their pricing is going to be significantly lower than those big retail brokers like the Schwabs and the TD Ameritrades and all those guys.
So yeah, it's interesting that you say there's not a lot of overhead, because I've and that a lot of what they do is program. Because for full disclosure, I do use Interactive Brokers for myself and for my company. And there have been maybe three or four times where I've had a call over to their trading desk, and I think four times. And three out of the four times, it's led me to the exact same person, which means that there probably aren't a lot of people there.
Yeah, they're maybe skipping on the customer service. That's, that is, and I also use Interactive Brokers. I didn't even know they were a public company until I started using them.
Yeah.
And, one of the things, when I went from a retail broker and a couple weeks later I was using Interactive Brokers, and I immediately noticed the execution difference. I mean, it's just night and day how much better pricing you get, on a typical Interactive Brokers order versus one of the retail brokers. Kind of back to your point, the customer service is certainly one of the larger complaints of a typical Interactive Brokers client. I feel like I've been extremely lucky, because I really don't have any complaints in their customer service department, but many other managers have complained about their customer service. So I know it is certainly an area that they need to improve on.
And they're also, their platform clearly isn't designed by actual designers. It's like designed by engineers.
No, I would love for them to go pick off some user experience people from Apple or something.
Yeah, that's definitely the area. So many of the things they do are counterintuitive. And especially, I've actually had new clients come on board, and then they got confused with the process, and I had to like walk them through it and get them on the phone. That's really been my only the execution's fantastic, but it's in terms of onboarding people, sometimes it's been difficult for me.
Absolutely, and I would say the same thing. Especially a couple of my older clients, I've definitely had to be on the phone with them and kind of walk through the sign up process. It is something that Thomas Petterfees, the CEO, is well aware of. It's been brought up on the conference call before.
Here's a real life example, without giving anyone's privacy away. So I'm not even going to say how many, but I do manage several retirement IRA accounts, right? And there's a new IRA agreement that Interactive Brokers has come out with. And every account holder has to, on their own, sign the new agreement. Otherwise, their account could not be usable anymore, right? So seeing that as an advisor kind of freaks me out a little bit, right? And at least one of those clients hasn't signed the new agreement. There's a good chance they might not even know it exists, right? So they're going to – so Interactive Brokers, I got an email today saying, oh, we're gonna send out an email to your clients that they have to sign the new agreement. Whether they will they get it or not, I don't even know. courtesy call or something, and then them walking you through it on the phone. If you're the average person with a retirement account who's not looking at things and not paying attention, you might miss the email.
Oh, absolutely. And I have several clients who really aren't big investors. They're not checking their Interactive Brokers account or email on a regular basis. And it's funny you mention that, because I was just looking at that before we started this, like an hour ago, and thinking that I need to get on a few people to sign that thing.
Yeah. So that's the trade-off with cheap execution, right? You get great execution, and then you have to take on a few more managerial tasks yourself that you may not with other firms, which is part of the deal.
Absolutely.
So now tell me a little bit about your valuation with Interactive Brokers.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of similar to where food comes from in that it's very long-term based. One thing I try and do a lot is I find it so easy to get lost in the small details when you're investing. I think all those you know, the small financial details, all those things are important, but I so many times in my investing career I lose the forest because I'm looking at the trees, you know.
Yep.
So Interactive Brokers, when I think about Wall Street 10 years or 20 years from now, it's hard for me to imagine the most automated, lowest cost producer not doing very well in the next 10 or 20 years. It's very hard for me to imagine a Wall Street that is not significantly more automated and significantly more electronic than it is today. Mm-hmm. So I think now, of course, that, you know, that's not a hard evaluation, but I think, you know, just looking at high level, Interactive Brokers is kind of in a good position because they are clearly leading the way, you know, in that situation. In terms of more specific valuation, I think they're selling for like 18 or 20 times my estimate of earnings, which I use. I typically use like a EV to a normalized NOPAT, which I need to come up with a better way of how I value or what the multiple I use. But I basically take like operating profit, take out interest, and then I normalize a lot of things. So I try and look at it as not like, you know, 2016 results. I kind of try and normalize things over many years. So when I say like a normalized NOPAT, that's kind of what I mean. So it's selling for around like 18 or 20 times that number for what kind of I've come up with.
And how fast have they been growing their earnings just historically?
The past couple years they've been in the like 10 to 20% range growing. And I think, you know, I think they can easily, they grew accounts last year by like 15 or 16%. And if you know, the big question with Interactive Brokers is if they can move up market. So right now their average hedge fund client has $2.2 million of equity in their account. So that's, you know, that's a very small hedge fund.
Yeah.
And the big question is if they can, and they have 34 accounts that have over $100 million in them. So they dominate the small space, but they're very, very small in the bigger hedge fund space. And the big question is if they can move up market.
What stops if someone was to ask you a question like, what would stop, say, a company like Goldman Sachs from using their capital just to replicate the Interactive Brokers model?
That is, you know, certainly something that people ask on a regular basis. Certainly one of my blind spots in the Interactive Brokers investment is that I'm way too small to be a client of the big banks. So I don't know them as intimately as I do like the retail brokers who I've all used and Interactive Brokers, obviously. But I have tried to talk to a lot of people who have worked with the big banks. And, you know, I do hear similar things in that, not to the extent, because Goldman actually does have a lot of, you know, there's certainly, they have a lot of automated and a lot of electronic systems. But I do hear similar things in that they're just different corporate cultures. Whereas the Interactive Brokers, I think the top like six executives are all computer programmers, like over roughly half of employees are computer programmers, whereas, you know, those big banks and, you know, the retail brokers, certainly more, even more so, are just, they're more set up to be, you know, salesmen, basically, businessmen. So while it's certainly possible, and I think there's a much better chance of Goldman competing with Interactive Brokers than I think of Schwab competing with Interactive Brokers. Right. But, you know, you also got to realize that Interactive Brokers has been doing this for like 20 years, so they have a very large lead on anyone. There's really only one other company that is kind of a direct competitor to Interactive Brokers, amazingly. Like, there's really only one other fully automated electronic broker.
Which is who?
A company called Saxo Bank, which is based in Denmark, much smaller than Interactive Brokers. And I think because the, you know, scale is so important in this industry that their pricing is significantly worse than Interactive Brokers, and that's probably because they don't have the scale that Interactive Brokers has.
Have you thought about to, say, one of these larger banks that maybe they would just, instead of investing all this time and capital to replicate what they've done over the past 20 years, just that they would buy them out and there'd be consolidation?
Yeah, that's one of the tailwinds in the industry, is there is a lot of consolidation among broker dealers. There's like 3,800 broker dealers in the world right now, which is just crazy.
It's insane. Yeah.
And only like 300 of those actually clear trades. So the other, you know, 500 are just, you know, selling the order flow to someone else or whatever. They're like a mini prime or, you know, an introduced broker. So, you know, yeah, and you know, Thomas Peterffy, which is one of the risks, is Thomas Peterffy's getting old. So I absolutely think them selling at some point is a very real possibility. And, you know, I'm sure I would be happy with any sell. So that's a good thing.
Interesting. What are some of the biggest mistakes that you've made in your investing career?
You know, it's funny. I've told this story to people. I still remember my first like big investment mistake, which turned out to be a great thing. When I was first starting out, I started reading some like investment blogs, and I read this blog. I wish I could remember the name of the company. But I read this investment blog, and it was a great write-up. I liked it a lot, and I invested, doing like, you know, very little research of my own, just off this blog. And then a couple weeks later, a lawsuit gets filed, and the stock drops 50% in like instantly. And I remember like freaking out. I was checking the blog like every day to see if he posted an update. I emailed him, he never responded. So I eventually just sold the company, but it was kind of a light bulb went off that like the research cannot be outsourced to other people. Like I just invested in this company completely off someone who I don't even know. I just thought, you know, it was a good sounding investment thesis, and, you know, within weeks I lost 50%. So that was pretty stupid, but that was my first big one. And, you know, from that, I was like, you know, if I'm going to keep investing, if I'm going to take this, you know, somewhat seriously, I got to start doing all this work myself.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, that was at the very beginning. I would say since then, almost any mistake I've made has probably been because I've invested in, or I've fallen in love with the valuation as opposed to falling in love with the business quality. You know, certainly a lot of those have been commodity companies. And I think every mistake I've made probably in the past, you know, 4 years or something has been just focusing too much on valuation.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. 100% of the mistakes that I've made is when I got too obsessed about the valuation and lost sight of the actual company. 100%.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so easy to do. You know, you see a company, especially, you know, when nowadays when the market's up so much, you see a company selling like 8 or 10x, and you're just like, oh man, that, I mean, that's amazing. You don't even see that nowadays. But then you know, most of those companies are selling for 8x for a reason. And that's,
right.
you know, we talked about where food comes from and interactive brokers. That's kind of how I've, you know, evolved into looking at these really high quality companies, which, you know, most companies selling for, you know, interactive brokers is selling for 18 or 20x. They're selling for that for a reason, because they are a very high quality company.
So, you know, I've noticed in the value investing world, and neither is better or worse, right or wrong. I think it's just what your skill sets are. I like to think that I do have one of my competitive advantages is that I have a good sense of a management team. And I think you do too, just from what it sounds like. And I see there's sort of two different camps in the value investing world. There's the, I don't talk to management. I don't really, you know, care much of what they have to say because all CEOs are bullshitters and they're all going to prop their stock. So I'm just going to look at the numbers. And they're really good at that, right? It's like, that's what they do. And then there's some of these guys who say, you know what, I actually do think I can get a gauge of the management. I do have a feel of the way that CEOs talk. I even sometimes will talk to management and get a better feel of the company. And I see those very two distinct camps. And it seems like you're in the, I like to be on the side of good management. And I actually think I can know when there's a good operator. Because not everyone thinks they can know. And some people, yeah. I don't think, have that skill set. And I think you do.
Absolutely. Well, it has certainly been an evolution, because I would say, you know, 4 years ago, I don't know if I really talked to management at all. And I was definitely in the first camp. And yeah. then as I made some of those mistakes in like investing in lower quality companies, I realized, you know, this really isn't me. I do much better in these higher quality companies. And then, you know, finding higher quality companies with a great management team is just a hell of a combination.
Yeah. Interesting. Are there any other companies that you've been looking at that either you own or that seem interesting to you that you'd like to talk about?
I have not found anything interesting as of late, unfortunately. I think the most recent company I bought was I bought two stocks right at the beginning of the year. Elbit Vision Systems is a pretty interesting one. They actually do have a reasonable valuation, and I think they are a high quality company. but they sell cameras for textile manufacturers.
Okay.
And these cameras go right on the like the looms as it's producing textiles, and the cameras can pick up errors in the, like, if there's a hole in the textile or there's a tear or something like that, and these cameras can pick up the errors and, you know, pause the loom quicker than and more efficiently than human inspectors can, which right now, you know, almost all textile manufacturers have a bunch of humans that are watching the textile fly by and just doing, you know, inspections with their bare eyes.
Huh.
Yeah. So they're selling for, they're an Israel based company.
Where'd you find these guys?
I found that late last year I joined MicroCap Club.
Okay.
Which, it's been, they have a pretty solid community over there. I've enjoyed it so far. I think Elbit's the only company I've found, it's definitely the only one I've found that I, have actually invested in. They're selling for, I don't know, 14 or 15 times earnings. They have no debt, a lot of cash. They generate a lot of cash. The CEO was a co-founder of the company. He owns 30% or something. So there's a lot of, and they have, they're basically the only one, there are a couple small companies doing it, but The runway for their technology is just absolutely massive. Like 95% of the industry is using human inspectors and, you know, just doing it in a very inefficient way. And a lot of textile gets wasted. And so it's an interesting situation. It's kind of another one of those, like, where food comes from and mm-hmm. interactive workers. Like, when you think about this industry 10 years from now, are there still going to be a bunch of humans standing around textile looms watching, you know, looking for holes in the thing? Or is it going to be a far more automated electronic system?
Interesting. And then what was the other company that you purchased the stake in?
I think the only other company I bought this year is Callaway's Nursery. Might have bought in December, I'm not really sure. Mm-hmm. But they're they own like 20 some nurseries, or no, 19 nurseries in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Uh-huh.
And they...
I'm actually very familiar with this company.
Yeah, so the thing, I've actually followed them for, I don't know, 5 years or something, but historically they had crappy management, so I was never really interested. And then Peter came in and took over last year and... you know, has drastically improved operating margins. And so that's kind of what made me invest in the company, is having new management. And one thing, I absolutely avoid retail, but I do think nurseries is one example of retail that should survive the internet, just because, you know, you can take two plants that are the exact same type of plant and they look completely different. You know, it's one of those things you kind of need to go shop for in person. So I think it's a pretty stable, kind of technology-proof little business.
I have a question for you about retail. Mm-hmm. So we've had online retail catalogs before the internet, and, you know, that didn't put retailers out of business. Why do you think the internet's different, or do you not think it's different?
Well, I do think it's different. And, you know, I think the big thing is just so freaking easy. I mean, you know, Amazon is just the easiest example. But, like, I mean, every website I shop on, they know all my information. They have my credit card. Like, buying is just so... I have not been to a mall in... It's funny, me and my girlfriend were with a group of people, a group of like 10 people, and someone brought up malls.
Mm-hmm.
And not one person had been to a mall in the past like year or two or something.
Amazing.
I despise when I have to do in-person shopping. Although when we did buy some, back to Callaway's Nursery, my girlfriend and I moved into a new apartment last summer. And when we bought some plants, we did go find a nursery to buy the plants from.
Interesting. Right, because you can look at it, you can smell it.
Exactly. And, you know, there's a lot of plants that have, like, dead leaves and all kinds of stuff. You want one that's the right size, so.
So do you buy your clothes online?
Yes,
so,
I do.
So it's interesting. So in my circles, most of us still buy, I don't know many people who buy the majority of their clothes online, but I've known they've existed. So now that I'm talking to one, how do you figure out sizes and stuff like that?
I buy almost all my clothes from a company called Luxire. I'm actually not sure how to pronounce it. Luxire, and I'm not associated with them at all, but I think they're a great company, so I like to tell people about them.
I'm gonna Google this right now. Luxire.
Yeah, they have a long way to go on their.
Is it
on
the bespoke website. Shirts by Luxire, custom made at perfection? Is
yeah.
that what you're looking at?
So they, and there's definitely, so they do completely custom clothing. You know, you take all your measurements and everything. So there's definitely kind of a curve to it at the beginning. You know, you have to, you know, do a few trials with jeans and shirts. And but generally after two or three times, you can get your size, you know, damn near perfect. And they'll do cheap trial shirts like while you're trying to figure it out for $30 or something.
So, I mean, this is expensive shit. I mean, I'm looking at three pairs of boxers for $150.
Well,
holy shit.
I don't know, I don't buy my boxers from them.
Okay.
But I buy like jeans, dress pants, dress shirts, all that type of stuff from them, which, you know, it's definitely not cheap, but it's also, you know, their dress shirts are typically like $100 a piece. And okay. I think their pants are 100 to maybe 140 a piece, which I mean, if you go to a Brooks
right,
Brothers,
it's comparable.
I think it's very comparable.
Yeah,
so
custom denim, $80. That's pretty reasonable, especially for custom denim. Huh. Well, Luxeer for Men, the official online retailer of the Intelligent Investing Podcast for today.
Nice.
Yeah.
They'll love that.
Yeah, I'm sure. interesting. Well, you have an interesting story and certainly a very interesting approach to managing your investments. Are you relatively concentrated or do you diversify a bit?
I currently have 10 stocks.
So you're pretty concentrated.
I'm 75% invested, which I much prefer to be 100% invested, but I just really haven't found anything recently, and a couple stocks have run up, so I've sold them.
Why don't you buy more of Interactive Brokers or Where Foods Come From?
I actually did buy more of Where Food Comes From recently.
Okay.
Interactive Brokers, I'm very close. I think my buying price is in the 33s. It's in the 34s right now.
Okay.
But I do love that company, and it's not a huge position for me. So I.
What's your largest position? What percentage of the portfolio?
My largest position is Franklin Covey, which is. It's up. It was up 25% today, so now it's a larger position.
Okay.
But I think it's maybe 14% or something like that, 15% position.
What had you buy them?
They're going through a business transition right now, where that they historically sold management training to corporations. So if a company wanted to train 50 of their employees or something, they would pay $200 per employee for, you know, a certain training manual or training class or whatever. And so all the sales were one-off sales. And now they've been transitioning to kind of a SaaS model, basically, to where for that same $200 per employee, you get a one-year membership and you get access to everything Franklin Covey offers. And as I don't know if you ever invested in companies that are kind of going through that transition, but it really hurts the GAAP results. So their results a couple quarters ago looked really bad in terms of GAAP results. But if you looked at kind of the underlying business was improving a lot. And then they yesterday after hours, they released earnings, which is what they released, really good earnings, which is why the stock is up so much today. I think the market's finally realizing that they have kind of successfully transitioned the business, and the financials are going to look much, much better here very soon.
Interesting. Well, anything else you'd like to share or like to discuss?
I told you I'm a big reader.
What do you read?
I read a ton of books. I was going to ask you if you've got any book recommendations for me. Right now I'm reading a book which was inspired by my Interactive Brokers holding, actually, but it's a book called Dark Pools.
Okay.
Which is about dark pools on Wall Street and kind of how those got started and, you know, what effect they have on the markets. And, you know, kind of going back to, I'm completely self-taught investor, never worked on Wall Street. So while I think that is an advantage in a lot of ways, I certainly have some gaps in my knowledge of how Wall Street works in some facets. So I try and read a lot of books about Wall Street and stuff like that. So yeah, this has been a pretty interesting book right now.
Interesting. Well, I'll recommend a book for you since you have an interest in the way organizations run and good management and cultures. It's been a book that's been very life-changing for me called Tribal Leadership.
I have not heard of that.
Yeah, and I'm actually trying to get the author who's actually become a friend of mine, John King. I'm working to get him on one of these episodes. He's very, very interesting guy.
Cool. Yeah, I will check it out. You know, one book that people are always talking about their favorite investing books. Mm-hmm. And I think the book that had the most effect on me, I never see mentioned, so I'm going to give it a shout out here.
All right, yeah.
Is Creative Cash Flow Reporting, and it's actually a McKinsey book.
Huh.
It's kind of a textbook almost. It's certainly not a light read, but I learned a ton from it. I actually read it twice. And it's all about, financials, and, the title's kind of self-explanatory.
Yep.
A little. But yeah, just learn about, how companies can trick you in the financials. And it's very, very interesting. I read that several years ago, and I felt like that book had a hugely positive influence on my understanding of financial statements and all that.
Huh, interesting. Yeah. Well, before we finish, is there any, for people that might want to get in contact with you, what would be the best way for people to reach you?
Yeah, I run an investing blog, which is generally where I point people. It's egregiouslycheap.com, and generally blogging about small and micro cap companies and a lot of just kind of general topics that relate to investing. So I do some investment write-ups, but a lot of just general stuff as well.
Very cool. Well, Travis, it was a pleasure having you on.
Oh, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I know you're still early on in your financial career, so good luck to you in the future, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, you too.
All right, have a good day.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.